It's 12 o'clock.
We come from the communities we serve, and we serve the communities we come from. This is Black Sheep Radio, WOOL-FM, 91.5 Bellows Falls, community radio for the southern Vermont and New Hampshire borderlands.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hello, Bellows Falls. KMO here with Sea Realm Radio, and I have on the line Misha Lepetic. Misha, are you there?
Hello, Kato. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Say a few words so I can adjust your levels.
It's great to be here. Great to be talking with you again as well.
All righty. Hey, you sent me a bio, which I negligently failed to have up on screen in front of me when you called. Would you say something about yourself?
Sure. So I've been involved in technology for about the last 20 years or so, starting with the first wave of internet startups in San Francisco in the mid-1990s. And I've always worked at the interface between technology and organizations. And as such, I've been interested in questions of knowledge and power and things like that. And I tend to bring a more sociological lens to what I'm doing. So a lot of the writing that I've done over the last few years has been on that topic of what do we talk about when we actually talk about technology? What are the sets of questions that we should be entertaining? And in the meantime, I've been working, to bring, interesting and effective solutions to organizations. I just designed a knowledge management platform for the United Nations, for the UN Democracy Fund, and lately I've been turning my attention to working on a startup idea with a friend on bringing technological power to addressing conservation issues in the Congo Basin. So that's about it for the short bio. I can elucidate on any of these particular details if you wish.
Well, we can get into more detail in a bit. And for the podcast listener, that bit will be in just a couple seconds. But for people listening in real time on terrestrial radio or via the web live stream, I need to say a couple things about light-emitting diodes. Alrighty. So, Misha, I, in preparation for our conversation, not only read, but recorded myself reading aloud your essay on Three Quarks Daily, called Working on the Blockchain Gang, Part 2, which, for reasons that are beyond me, will not come up on my screen right now. So I'll be going from memory for the most part. It's fairly heady stuff. We can get lost in the weeds rather easily. So I'm going to ask you to make an effort to think about the people who are really not familiar with blockchain at all and keep it simple. And before that, even, just to make it really accessible, let me ask you, have you been watching either Star Trek Discovery or The Orville?
I have not, actually. I can't count myself as a Star Trek fan, unfortunately.
Well, I can highly recommend The Orville, even to people who are not Star Trek fans, but I think diehard Star Trek fans are really grateful for The Orville because Star Trek Discovery is tonally, thematically, and visually very distinct from any Star Trek project that has come before. It's very much of the moment, whereas The Orville is filling the space, the conceptual and emotional space that Star Trek, the actual IP holders of Star Trek vacated when they took their Star Trek, to darker, more, so-called adult realms. But you haven't seen them, so we can't talk about that. So we got to get to the hard stuff.
I'm sorry, I couldn't give you an easy out there.
No, that's okay. That's okay. So what is a I want to start with the notion of a distributed ledger, because that sounds simultaneously incredibly boring and really hard to visualize. What is that?
Right. So, and yeah, it is. It's a very, I think it's a very foreign concept for people to grasp. And there's been a lot of hand-waving around what does it actually do, and a lot of that is also wrapped up in, this presumption of how great it is. So let's let's just kind of look at it dispassionately. I think the thing with distributed ledger technology to as a way of beginning to understand it is start from the point of view of trust. So when you engage in a transaction with someone, you know, a lot of the times when we engage with engage in transactions, we don't know the person on the other end of the transaction. We're depending on all sorts of other bodies or institutions to help us mediate that transaction. So if I apply for a loan, or if I sign a contract with somebody, or I open a bank account or anything like that, you know, over, you know, the last couple of centuries, really, but you know, certainly after in the post-war era, you know, we've come to depend on, you know, these trusted intermediaries, so to speak, so that, you know, for example, if I open a bank account and I put, you know, a certain amount of money in that bank account, that I have the FDIC guaranteeing that if the bank goes belly up, then I'm insured for up to, I don't know, what it is, $250,000 or whatever. You know, and then this also scales up to much larger, you know, guarantors, like the Federal Reserve setting interest rates, the government saying this is how much a dollar is worth, like back when we were on the gold standard, things like that. So where blockchain or distributed ledgers kind of slip into the, or insert themselves into the conversation is, you know, what do you do when you can't trust anybody? Or can we have a scenario where you don't need to trust anybody? And how do you actually accomplish that? And that's where the distributed ledger comes in. So this was first implemented concretely by Bitcoin in 2008. And essentially, I don't want to get too far into the weeds of describing how the mechanics work. But essentially what happens is that if you, we can illustrate this in an analog way. We can imagine everybody sitting around the table. Like say there's like 10 people sitting around the table. And we all want to transact with one another, you know, some sort of product or service or whatever it is. But we don't know each other. We don't trust each other. So the way to visualize distributed ledger technology is that if each person has a notebook and a pen, and as you're transacting, you write down your own transactions, and you write down everyone else's transactions. And then you get to a point where you have to reconcile the ledgers. And when you do that and there's agreement, then that is essentially what's called a block of transactions. And that block is then chained to all the previous transactions that have transpired at that table. So there's kind of a collective effort to make sure that everyone is on the same page, quite literally in this case. Now, when you kind of abstract this into a technological setting, you know, you have computers doing this whole thing. And the innovation that the Bitcoin protocol came up with was in answering the question, how do you incentivize people to do this? Okay, I mean, this sounds like an interesting mechanism, but how do you actually get people to devote computing resources to making this a possibility? And what they came up with was the idea of cryptocurrency and basically incentivizing people to perform these calculations, to perform these reconciliations, and to be rewarded by cryptocurrency, which is essentially a completely internal construct that has nothing to do with money. This is one of the things that's like very confusing to people about cryptocurrency in general. But I need to talk about cryptocurrency just a tiny bit in order to, you know, explain the whole blockchain distributed ledger phenomenon, because it's about the reward mechanism. So when all of these you know, computing entities come together to create this next set of transactions that would constitute a block, then the first entity to reconcile everything and to reach a particular, you know, resolution is rewarded with this cryptocurrency. And so that then becomes the mechanism to keep the whole paradigm moving forward.
So this is the process known as mining, right?
Right. This is what's called mining.
So people have probably heard of Bitcoin mining. That's what's going on.
Right. And I think like mining as a term is somewhat misleading, because you know you're not at some digital coalface where you know you're discovering shiny new Bitcoin every once in a while. Essentially, this is really about ledger reconciliation, because your ledger has to be, you know, if you and I have a transaction, and then the third person at the table says, I don't have a record of that transaction, then that has to be reconciled somehow, because the entire network has to agree on the authoritative version of the block before the Bitcoin can be released. And to the miner who performed the reconciliation first. So it winds up being, it's really interesting in terms of how this market was designed, because the incentive is for everyone to agree, otherwise nobody gets any Bitcoin. So that's what keeps the blockchain moving forward in terms of Bitcoin. And that's also what keeps the blockchain moving forward in terms of all of the other iterations and elaborations that have come along since then.
Okay, I'll ask you about some of the specifics of that in a moment, but and with apologies to the real-time audience, we're going to have to take a minute and do a little technical housekeeping. I'll cut this out of the podcast version.
Kemo, can you hear me now?
Oh, way better.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's what I get for buying a cheap headset.
Well, I think even a cheap headset would be fine. I think there's probably a settings issue that the headset just wasn't even doing anything.
Okay. All right, well, you know, back to the old school.
Well, old school as in smartphone.
Right. Well, at this point, I mean, I still have my iPhone 5S, so I'm part of the iPhone old school, I'd say.
Okay. This is maybe a rude question. I don't mean it in that spirit, but how old are you?
Oh, I'm 46.
Okay. So just a couple years younger than me. You're a Gen Xer.
Mm-hmm.
And you spent most of your life in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
So by 20th century standards, an iPhone, what'd you say, 5?
5S.
5S?
Yeah, I think it's like circa 2013 or so.
Yeah, that is a technological marvel.
That is
a gift from heaven. That is some technology so advanced it might have well come from an alien civilization, you know, to say somebody in 1982.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty remarkable still.
Yeah. So let's get back to the blockchain, you know, just a little levity there to maybe cleanse the palate. I know this is a kind of a rude question to ask, but can you summarize the most important points of the things that we have said thus far in the first 10 minutes of this conversation?
Oh, sure. I think the question is around, and it's a totally legitimate question, like why should we care about the blockchain, you know, what or distributed ledger technology, like what difference is that going to make in anyone's life? And there's a really great Medium essay posted by someone named Adam Ludwin a couple of weeks ago, where he...
How do you spell that last name?
I'm sorry?
Adam who?
Ludwin, Ludwin. And it's called an open letter to Jamie Dimon, and I'll send you the link so you can post it. And I think he does a really good job in kind of saying, well, what's the difference between, you know, distributed ledger technology and all the stuff that we have already? And so as I was saying, you know, on my, you know, my handicapped headset discussion, you know, the distributed ledger allows for verified and trustless interaction. So I don't need to know who you are. You don't need to know who I am. The fact that we're participating in this network, the way that the network is designed, allows us to have trustless interaction that can be verified, that can be valid. Now, it doesn't involve any intermediaries. You don't have to rely on a single source of truth to say, I know the source doesn't say, I know who Kamo is and I know who Misha is, and it doesn't matter that they don't know each other, but I know who they are and they're okay, and therefore this transaction is okay. This blockchain and distributed ledger dispenses completely with this idea, which is really powerful. You know, I'm not discounting the power of that at all. But I think that when you look at the existing infrastructures for transactions, you know, like just if we take the example of payments, you know, if you're doing stuff with the Visa network or Swift or PayPal or things like that, like those are really mature networks and those work really quickly. And there's a lot of security and there's a lot of redundancy built in. There are guarantors for when a transaction goes bad, like you have recourse, you know, like these are really powerful, you know, aspects of what makes these systems robust and successful. And if you look at the way Bitcoin and other distributed ledger technologies are currently organized and the scale at which they're functioning, the efficiency at which they're functioning, they can't really hold a candle to the way that you know, Swift and existing payment networks actually function. So I'm actually drawing from Adam Ludwin's argument here, and the distinction that Ludwin makes, I think correctly, is that the one thing that distributed ledger technologies can provide to people that none of these payment networks can provide is censorship-free transactions. So there is nothing to stop. If you and I are on a distributed ledger and we're transacting, we're exchanging products or services or whatever, there is nothing in that network that can prevent us from having this transaction. The code will get executed. If you and I want this code to get executed, it gets executed. There's nothing in the network to stop that. There's no governance. And it's specifically designed that way. So why would that be useful? Well, it would be useful.
Well, that lets you buy weed online.
Well, you know, that's definitely been one of the major use cases. We can kind of talk about, like, you know, the nefarious deployments or shadier deployments of technology, you know, throughout history to you know, do these sorts of things. But at the same time, you know, like, for example, there was a case where, you know, PayPal, this was a few years ago, where PayPal stopped processing donations to WikiLeaks. And I think that was as a result of pressure that was brought against PayPal by, I don't know if it was the Department of Justice or something like that, you know, and this was like right around the time of Cablegate, I believe.
Yeah. And at the same time, Amazon.com also refused to render payments to WikiLeaks.
Yeah.
So it was a multi-front embargo against WikiLeaks, trying to starve them of donations.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I mean, whatever you think of WikiLeaks, totally aside, this is a great example of censorship, you know, and the kind of censorship. I mean, when we think about censorship, we usually think about free speech and, you know, all that stuff. But the freedom to engage in transactions also falls under, you know, the temptations of censors. And one of the things that a distributed ledger technology does is it really removes that bottleneck from any given system. So, you know, of course, you have to balance that against the all of the other shortcomings of distributed ledger technologies that exist right now. You know, they can't handle millions of transactions a second. You know, there's no recourse. Like if you're Bitcoin or or any other digital coin gets hacked. You can't go to any, you know, authority and say, I got hacked, like, give me some of my money back. Or I want to go after these guys. Like, you know, there's nobody to actually enforce any of this stuff.
And that has happened.
It's a trade-off.
There have been hacks of Bitcoin trading desks, and people have lost money that way.
Oh, there is an unbelievable amount of hacking going on in this space. I think it's a very tricky space to be in. You know, if anyone is thinking of investing in, you know, what are so-called initial coin offerings or Bitcoin or stuff like that, I mean, I think it's a very fraught space to be in. You know, partly because there's that temptation of free money, a lot of free money, you know, on the part of you know, the people who are performing the hacking, and then it's also a very high temperature, in the sense that you know, there's a real bubble going on in the amount of money that's being raised and what it's being raised for, and is it actually a useful technology, or is this something that's being, you know, targeted by, you know, the latest iteration of pump and dump schemes, as has always happened with any sort of asset or security. So yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous amount of risk associated with actually engaging in this stuff. And, you know, everyone should, you know, I think that people read about the incredible rise in prices of, you know, how much a Bitcoin is worth or how much a Ether is worth or anything like that. And they say, I want a piece of that. And yeah, you know, go out and get a piece of it, but be prepared to lose it all and not be able to go to anyone like, you know, the SEC and say, you know, I was defrauded, because, you know, people will just shrug their shoulders.
Let me share an anecdote with you. I was part of a three-way interview with somebody who was working for a company that was using blockchain for something. And among other things, they had their own cryptocurrency. And while the other person was talking, I was just doing some quick research online. There is something, there's a little less than 200 different national currencies in the world. And of those, like 190-something, really, there's only four or five that anybody really cares about. You know, there's the U.S. dollar, there's the euro, there's the yen, there's the yuan or renminbi or whatever you want to call the Chinese currency. And thereafter, you know, there's the Russian currency. I don't think it's the ruble anymore. And thereafter, you know, we don't really care. We don't care about, you know, what currency they're using in, you know, name whatever obscure country you want to. And then I looked to see how many different cryptocurrencies there were. There's over 1,000.
Right.
And really, we only care about Bitcoin and Ethereum and maybe Litecoin and maybe a couple others. But really, there's very few players that are of any significance whatsoever. So if you hear about the easy money of getting in on that initial coin offering, there are very, very few of these players which are going to survive very long at all.
Yeah. And a lot of this is being driven by you know, the sort of numbers game strategy, a lot of this investing, because you're having so many of these cryptocurrencies being launched, you know, as you say, like over 1,000. And people who have, you know, already invested in Bitcoin or Ether and who have seen like really phenomenal returns, you know, there's a mindset where they're playing with the house's money. And, you know, they've made so much that, you know, they can afford to spray it around and just keep buying more and more of these, you know, new cryptocurrencies. And the idea of, well, what are these cryptocurrencies actually for? And is this a useful technology? Is it designed well? Does it actually address a need in the marketplace? Will there be like real liquidity? Those are really open questions. But the fact that there is so much, money sloshing around and looking to, you know, invest itself in this new paradigm, that winds up really inflating, you know, these initial coin offerings. So that, I think like a good proxy for this or a good analogy for this is the penny stock market, you know, where somebody gets in at 30 cents and then they sell at 60 cents, you know, and they've doubled their money, but this is, you know, some fly-by-night company that doesn't really have any earnings and, you know, is very thinly traded and can disappear overnight. But that's not the problem of, you know, these people. The people who are making these investments are really, you know, they're doing it from the point of view of the greater fool theory, that they'll have somebody to, once they've bought at 30 cents, that they'll have somebody to sell to at 60 cents. And they're done. There's no real commitment to actually, you know, using the distributed ledger technology that is actually associated with, you know, with that currency, with that cryptocurrency, rather.
Let me read something from your essay. This isn't your writing. This is the basically the mission statement of a group called Democracy Earth, and this is what they intend to do with the blockchain technology. They want to disintermediate politics, and in their words, "We seek nothing less than the true democratic governance for the internet age, one of the foundational building blocks of an achievable global peace and prosperity arising from an arc of technological innovations that will change what it means to be human on Earth." That's huge. Yeah. I mean, what is it about the you know, this ledger, the blockchain technology, which causes people to wax rhapsodic like that?
Yeah, I mean, those Democracy Earth guys are really quite extraordinary. And when the event that I saw them, which I saw them was organized by a meetup group called Blockchain for Social Good or Social Impact. And they're actually, I believe, Argentinian. And they started out as, you know, there's been this trend over the last 10 years or so of, you know, the internet-based political parties. I think, you know, some listeners might be familiar with the Pirate Party in Sweden, and I think there's a few other iterations around the world. And you know, I think that these people are coming from a pretty, you know, well-known precedent of, you know, young people who are looking around and saying, this political system is not serving us, and we're going to run for office and make everything better, right? I mean, you know, that's great. I mean, how else did anything happen, you know, as far as the political process goes from a progressive point of view? Where things get interesting is that, you know, Democracy Earth and, you know, the Pirate Party and all that stuff, they look at technology as, and particularly internet-based technologies, as a principal organizing force for, you know, creating and cultivating and sustaining political power, which is very different from the way that, you know, political parties have traditionally arisen and maintain themselves. Now, I don't think that this sort of movement has had a lot of success yet, but I think it remains to be seen as well. Now, to get to the quote that, you know, you read, so this is from their manifesto, which is available on their website, and it's really, you know, how do you... But the question that they're wrestling with is, you know, how do you avoid corruption? And I think corruption, from the, you know, political point of view, in countries like Argentina, is a very different beast than corruption as we understand it here in the United States. I can't really, you know, comment much more intelligently on that, but I think that, you know, it's important to keep in mind, like, what our definitions are and how our definition of something like corruption may be different in this context, in the American context, versus anything else. So I think that the Democracy Earth guys kind of, they look at this, they look at distributed ledger technology and the extension of distributed ledger technology, which are smart contracts, and they say, here's a possible way forward for us. Now, when I read that paragraph, or when I read that paragraph, the thing that struck me was, you know, there's this kind of very strange confluence of kind of libertarian utopianism, and yeah, how else to put it, world government. You know, there's this really, like, we all get to fulfill our destiny, and because we fulfill our destiny, like, somehow everything is great. And there are really interesting issues that arise out of, you know, when people take these technologies and they extend them out into, like, truly planetary scale. Like, is that something that really, you've blown so far past the idea of unintended consequences. I mean, I think it's difficult enough to actually think about, you know, unintended consequences from the point of view of something really small. You know, like, you're just going to do distributed ledger technology for, you know, payments, or you're going to create a new asset class like bonds or something like that. What could possibly go wrong? Well, we can think about a lot of things that could go wrong. But you know, looking at the Democracy Earth guys, and they're saying, you know, we want to completely rewrite the way politics is performed, you know, in the sense of, well, what would be the unintended consequences of that? It's really difficult to even, you know, begin talking about what those unintended consequences could look like.
Well, as you mentioned in the article, when you disintermediate politics, you know, what are the political intermediaries? Right now, they're people. So
right.
Disintermediating politics means taking people out of that system and replacing them with algorithms.
Yes.
What could go wrong, as you say?
Right. And you know, I, later on in the piece, I talk about I think it was Peter Reinhardt and the below and above the API, this idea of below and above the API.
Okay, here it is. Before we talk about API, I need to say that you are listening to C-Realm Radio on WOOL FM 91.5, Bellows Falls, Vermont, Black Sheep Radio. And I'm KMO. I'm speaking with Misha Lepetic, and we are talking about heady, heady topics. In fact, in your Three Quarks Daily piece, you linked to an article in The Atlantic where the author admits that he has been pretending for years to understand cryptocurrency. And now he's kind of had a revelation where it's not that he understands it so well, but he can finally admit and unburden himself that he doesn't understand it and that a lot of smart people don't understand it. And I don't want to give the impression that I understand it. I can basically repeat back what I have heard and read about it, but it doesn't mean that I'm really grokking the whole concept. But now we're going to get into deeper waters. You are going to define for us what an application programming interface is.
Sure. So, I just want to, you know, riff on what you just said about us not understanding what this stuff is. And I think that that's really true for many, many, many people. Even people who are in this space really don't understand it. And I think that if you listen to, you know, what the discussion that we've been having and the things that I've been saying, I'm sure that somebody would listen to this and say, that guy really has no idea what he's talking about. I think that it's very much like, you know, the three blind men and the elephant, or six blind men. I don't know how many blind men there were.
Nobody can
API,
report accurately because they were all blind. They, you know, just had to count voices.
So as far as application programming interface goes, this is actually a little easier to explain. So it's a software concept. And essentially, the API, if you build a system that does X, Y, and Z, and then I build a system that does, you know, P, D, and Q, how do we get these systems to communicate to one another? How do we get information? How are we able to exchange data, information, process requests? You know, what rights do I have to change aspects of your database or update aspects of your database, and vice versa? And essentially, that's what an API is. If we kind of go with a biological metaphor, the API is the cell membrane. So we know with cell walls that, you know, certain chemicals can pass, or certain compounds can pass through, and others can't. And you know, that's essentially what an API is. So an API basically it hides the states and the behaviors that don't need to be exposed to the outside world, that are necessary for the internal functioning of the system. And it exposes those aspects that, you know, do need to be shared, that can be modified, that can be updated. So that's essentially, you know, what an API is. And we access APIs all the time. Like every time, you know, we log on to the internet, or, you know, we're, you know, using any social media or anything like that. There's always an API in place. You don't see it. You can't say, computer, show me the API. These things are, you know, they're hidden. They're accessible to developers and people who know what they're doing as far as code goes. But these things are not, you know, they're not like blindingly obvious. So in the sense of, you know, how does this fit into my argument? The API essentially, the way in which APIs have been constructed in the way that Peter Reinhardt is talking about is APIs tell you what to do. They tell you what's possible, you know, and you know, the example of Uber, for example, is really fantastic, because Uber, you know, disintermediates the need for humans to process requests for transportation. So you need a car, you've got your Uber app, you figure out where you are, you figure out where the car is, you know, you dial the guy, you know, you request the guy who's closest to you. He gets the request, he accepts it, and then you watch him come to you on your smartphone screen. He picks you up, drives you to where you need to be, you're done, right? Now, the thing is that this API, or the platform itself, is so developed that there's absolutely no need for human interaction, like in the sense that there are no humans brokering this this match between supply and demand. So what's the consequence of that? The consequence is that, you know, on a superficial level, you have software that, you know, the person, the buyer of the service, is telling the software what he or she wants. And the person who's providing the service is responding to what the software is telling them. So essentially the software is dictating, you know, or exerting a pretty definitive amount of control over what this person is doing. It's not like if you were calling a taxi cab company and you called the dispatcher and the dispatcher says he'll be there in 5 minutes, and you say, well, I said I was on this corner, but now I'm on that corner. Like, you know, can you meet me on this other place? And fine, sure, no problem. Like, all that stuff is out the window, right? But this is fine from the point of view of efficiency. You know, if we're just talking about an efficiency argument, this is great. This is exactly what we want. The thing that happens at the same time as a result of this, you know, API, is the fact that, the people who were, you know, who constituted an entire organizational layer, in these companies is now gone. They're replaced by software. They were replaced essentially by the API. And what that does is it introduces a fracture in the way that labor relations are structured in, you know, contemporary society. So, what do I mean by that? It was kind of like a grandiose statement. But what that essentially means is that, you know, if you start off as an Uber driver, and you like the company and you want to work your way up, there's nowhere to work your way up to, you know, like you're essentially always an Uber driver.
You can't get promoted to middle management because middle management is all software.
Right.
That's what you mean when you say that there's two kinds of people in the world. Let me have you finish that. There's two kinds of people in the world.
Yeah. So there's two kinds of people in the world. The people who tell software what to do and the people who are told by software what to do.
So if you're an Uber driver, you're in that second category.
Right. And furthermore, and this is that phrase below the API. Like that, you're as an Uber driver, you are below the API. You're being told what to do by the software, and you have no recourse. I mean, you can turn down.
You can quit.
right, but you can quit. Obviously, there's always exit. But in the sense that, if you turn down too many rides, they're just going to fire you, because you're not pulling your weight. And this isn't something where like you can go to an HR manager and you can say, I was sick and I couldn't work. My wife was pregnant. I had to take her to the hospital. Like, no, they don't, it's software. It doesn't care. So that's kind of, when this kind of disintermediation occurs, then there's nowhere for people to go, in the sense of like their mobility, their career mobility, the mobility of their labor is really restricted. And the only other thing that I'll add about, the whole above and below the API thing, is that those people who are stuck below the API are actually under further pressure, in the sense that the research and development that's going on right now, in terms of automation, which is another kind of big word that, deserves a multi-hour unpacking, but at least for the purpose of this conversation, the efforts towards automation are, vastly being pointed at, the jobs and the processes that exist below the API. And again, the example that I bring up in my essay is about Uber, and the fact that it's not a secret that Uber is looking to develop its driverless car fleet, and that eventually they want to replace all human drivers with autonomous vehicles. So if you're someone like an Uber driver who's stuck below the API, not only do you not have a way to move up in the world, at least within the confines of that company, but your job is also under threat of being extinguished by automation, because that's what the API is doing. That's what the API as a sort of construct is seeking to take on ever more tasks for itself, to perform those tasks with efficiency, because that's how we define everything. And then, within 5 to 10 years or however many, we want to talk about autonomous vehicles, and when they're coming, but they're coming. And then these people will all be out of jobs. And then what do you retrain them for? So that's essentially, the whole above and below the API argument.
Well, let me add one more element to this being below the API. And instead of Uber, let's talk about Amazon's Mechanical Turk, although I think the same applies for Uber. The Mechanical Turk workers, the ones doing these so-called human intelligence tasks, solving CAPTCHAs and taking surveys and things like that, they can't collectively bargain with Amazon because they interact with Amazon through the API, and they don't know who their fellow Amazon Turk workers are.
Right.
And Amazon,
right. Absolutely.
And that's not an accident, So
yeah.
If you don't know who your coworkers are, you can't organize with them to bargain collectively with your employer.
Yeah.
And
what's
more, because the person for whom you are doing work, or the company for whom you are doing work, and who is paying you for that work, in 20th century terms would be your employer, but that's not the model anymore. Now, there's many layers or many ways to outsource labor, so that rather than paying a worker to do work, you are paying a contractor to organize laborers to provide a result to you. And you have no obligations as the person or the entity at the top of that food chain to care whatsoever what workers are paid or what conditions they work under. So that again is to the advantage of what used to be employers and who now through technology and fancy language deny that they're employers.
Right, absolutely. And there have been efforts for Mechanical Turk workers to kind of find each other. There are forums out there, but in the sense of, I think that it's so broken. Like the way labor is structured in the gig economy is so broken that I don't know what organizing looks like. It's one thing when you kind of go back to the kind of classic factory setting where enough people say we're going to slow down the work today or we're going to go on strike. And and this is not even talking about unions. I mean, just talking about a bunch of people agreeing to do something. Like this is happening within a physical place, and there's a certain power invested in place. And when you're talking about the kind of disintermediation that's occurred with software and with the gig economy, then you're just talking about individuals, and their labor is so atomized. And it's so virtual, and it's so easy to turn over. I mean, in a sense, like I think that people talk about turnover of Mechanical Turk workers or Uber drivers or whatever, and they say like, well, these are bad companies because they turn over like half their workforce every year or something like that. And I look at it from the point of view that it's not a bug; it's a feature. I mean, you want that kind of turnover because you don't need to. Because what that means is that the amount of training that you need to do is really minimal, to get somebody up and running. Like you basically, they know how to drive already. They download the app. Now they're an Uber driver. You have an internet connection and a place to sit. You can be an Amazon Turk worker. And so this kind of creates like a really radically expanded, supply of labor that is very low skilled, and it doesn't need to be any more than how it's skilled because of all of the stuff that, all the work that is being done by the API, by the platform itself. So I don't even know what organizing looks like in this kind of scenario. I think it's very, very concerning.
So in your article, you talk for a time about UBI or universal basic income, and you sort of bring it up as a way to introduce the concept of the blockchain or the distributed ledger, which is easier to grasp. And we, in very unnecessarily difficult fashion, have taken it in the reverse order and did the blockchain first. But in these last few minutes, let's talk about some of the implications for universal basic income as it figures in this ecosystem of what used to be called employers and workers, who used to be employees but are no longer employees, and the tasks or the space that the workers occupy right now in this ecosystem of, paid work is understood by just about everybody to be a really, really temporary space because artificial intelligence is eating the world. It is learning to do all those things that Uber drivers and Amazon Mechanical Turk workers do. It's learning to solve those CAPTCHAs. It's learning to, understand, what words mean. It's not there yet, but it's getting better and better. For example, I think most people are familiar with Deep Blue, which was the chess program that beat, I think it was Garry Kasparov, back mm-hmm. in the waning hours of the 20th century.
Yeah, but, I think that was 1997, yeah.
But there is a much more complicated, nuanced, and abstract game called Go. And mm-hmm. even as recently as a few years ago, leading AI researchers, were saying that a computer or an algorithm that's going to beat a human Go grandmaster is a couple decades away. And
right.
it happened.
Yeah.
So there was an AI called AlphaGo, and it's now called AlphaGo Li because it beat the grandmaster of Go, the world champion at that game, the human champion. His last name was Li. Well, that program, AlphaGo, now it's called AlphaGo Li, it did rely on some machine learning techniques, but it also had this huge library of previous human Go games to draw upon. And
yes.
the people who developed the software actually trained it, intentionally. Well, the next iteration of that program, I forget what it's called, but they basically had it play games against itself. They didn't teach it anything. They didn't give it any strategies. They didn't give it, any repository of previous games to look at and make inferences from. They just said, play against yourself and build on the results. And in just a few days, the AI taught itself to play Go so well that it beat the previous version, the one that had beaten the human grandmaster, 100 games to nothing.
Yep, that's absolutely correct.
With no training at all.
Just basically
being created and say, here, not to be gross, but play with yourself. And it did.
Right.
And it got so good so quickly that it blew away the AI that the humans had trained.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I think that the new iteration is called AlphaGo Zero.
Yes, that's it.
And you know, the thing about this accomplishment, and it's an accomplishment. There's no doubt. It's actually really remarkable. And the way that Demis Hassabis, who's the CEO of DeepMind, that was bought by Google, who's been kind of involved in this, development of AI, via game playing. There are older videos where, AIs that his company has developed have taught themselves to play arcade games, like Atari, Space Invaders, stuff like that. And the thing that's interesting about this particular line of inquiry is that you're talking about a game space. And even though Go is vastly more complex than chess, in the sense of the number of possible moves in any given game and the strategies that can be employed and all that stuff, these are still games that have very clear rules. These are still games that are finite. They're bounded. The point of the game is to win. There's an end to any single iteration, and I think that one of the things that we're seeing with AI is that we're getting to this point where, as long as the rules are really clear, we can construct AIs that are really insightful and profound in the conclusions that they reach. But when you move to a space where the rules aren't as well defined, where there's some kind of slipperiness within the boundaries of, is this, a legitimate move, for example, then I think things get really much, much dicier. And I'd be very interested to see, when you're talking about, when we're talking about things like AIs interpreting the environment around them. So, for self-driving cars, there was a piece, I think it was in Design Observer about a month ago, when talking about, what do self-driving cars actually see? Like, how do they map the world around them? And there was a picture of a particular input using laser detection for how a self-driving car describes the world to itself. And the picture was of a street scene. It was, not quite monochromatic, but it's pretty much about the textures, and you can quite clearly see. You can see trees, you can see cars, you can see signs and stuff like that. And the thing that really struck me about this illustration was that the sky was black. I'm sorry.
What does the car care about the sky?
Right. Right. I mean, the car can't see any clouds. It can't see the sun. I mean, you can see, if you're talking about, some kind of infrared sensing, then, it can see the sun by proxy, but it can't look up and see the sun. I thought that was a really interesting, moment of just, for me personally, of kind of understanding what it is that machines can actually see, and how they're still bounded by, the attributes that we decide.
Hey, Misha, we have 2 minutes left in the hour, so let me encourage you to bring it to a conclusion.
Oh, sure. So, we've covered a lot of ground, and we've kind of gone really far away from distributed ledger technology.
But we didn't get to UBI, which is okay.
Yeah. I mean, I how much more time do we have?
Less than 2 minutes. We got about 90 seconds.
Yeah. You know what? I'll close with this. I mean, you know, the whole discussion about what is UBI or what is blockchain or all that stuff. That's great. The thing that I would really be concerned about, transmitting to your listeners and to anyone I talk to, really, is, starting from the principle of how do we think about technology, and not so much about thinking about technology itself, but thinking about what kind of a society is this technology going to create. And it's not so much about don't answer that question by saying, well, these are the problems that UBI is going to solve, or these are the problems that blockchain is going to solve. You have to think beyond that, and you have to say, well, okay, if UBI or blockchain constructs this sort of solution, then what gets displaced? What gets retired? What becomes obsolete? What new structures and new power structures arise as a result of, not just the technology itself, but who owns that technology and who's first in line to benefit from that technology? I would begin any conversation about, what does X do with those questions.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to wrap it up there. Everybody, this has been KMO talking with Misha Lepetic on C-Realm Radio. Thanks so much for listening.